Welcome to the Counter Financial Crime Cast from the Association of Certified Financial Crime Specialists. The Crime Cast brings you the latest news, analysis, and actionable guidance from leading experts in the international counter financial crime community. My name is Brian Kindle, Editorial Director with ACFCS, and this week we'll be speaking with Kathy Phelps, a Los Angeles-based lawyer who specializes in large-scale litigation related to Ponzi schemes. In this episode, we'll be addressing an increasingly visible and critical issue in the financial crimes field, the liability of financial institutions and other third parties in fraud cases, with a particular focus on Ponzi cases. The economic recession has brought on the collapse and exposure of numerous Ponzi schemes, exemplified in the headlines by the likes of Bernard Madoff, Alan Stanford, Scott Rothstein, Mark Dreher, and others. Including those of less notoriety, these schemes strip victims of billions of dollars, not only in the United States, but also throughout the world. In the aftermath of such frauds, the victims are often left with bleak recovery options. A recent case in Florida brought by victims of mega fraudster Scott Rothstein indicates a new avenue of recovery. That route aims at the financial institutions where the fraudsters maintain their accounts. The case against TD Bank has already produced a $67 million verdict in favor of Coquina Investments, one of Rothstein's victims, and it has significant implications for fraud victims and financial institutions alike. It is one of several recent civil suits that have alleged that banks and other third parties, including lawyers and auditors, who conducted business with fraudsters, should be held liable for their role in Ponzi schemes. Consequently, third parties may now face a heightened and very expensive risk of being held liable for a fraud perpetrated by one of their customers. We'll be examining the landmark case against TD Bank and its potential impact on third-party liability and other fraud and financial crime cases. We'll also provide practical tips and due diligence procedures that financial institutions and other third parties may use to detect fraud and avoid liability. We'll finish with a discussion of some of the recent developments in the ongoing and always fascinating Bernard Madoff case. Kathy Phelps, our guest expert, is a partner at Danning, Gill, Diamond & Collitz, a bankruptcy boutique firm in Los Angeles. For over 20 years, she has represented trustees, receivers, debtors, and other parties in bankruptcy and receivership proceedings. She handles large-scale litigation matters with a focus on litigation arising in fraudulent schemes such as Ponzi schemes. Recently, she has co-authored The Ponzi Book, a legal resource for unraveling Ponzi schemes, which has been described as the go-to resource and one-stop shopping for understanding the facts and legal strategies necessary in the unwinding of a Ponzi scheme. The book has received an endorsement from none other than Irving Picard, who some of our listeners may recognize as the trustee in the Madoff case. Well, Kathy, thank you very much for being here. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, let's jump in and get started. What is the hottest legal theory being used to find third parties liable in Ponzi cases these days?
Well, one of the claims that we're seeing brought a lot against some pretty deep pocket defendants is the theory of aiding and abetting. And this is where there's some sort of a wrongful conduct like a fraud or a breach of fiduciary duty, and the defendant being sued is alleged to have actual knowledge of that fraud or whatever the wrongful conduct is, and that they substantially assisted in it, and that there have been some sort of damages brought. And these claims are being brought against financial institutions, against lawyers, against auditors, and other defendants with a lot of money, and these can really lead to some very significant damage claims. And the trend has been, it's been a little tough to find defendants liable on this theory, but there's a lot going on right now in some of the bigger Ponzi cases. And let me give you just two quick examples. One of them in the Madoff case, we have our trustee Irving Picard, who's been, you know, suing. We've been reading a lot about it in the press, and he sued, for example, J.P. Morgan, the primary bank of the Madoff enterprise, on the theory of aiding and abetting fraud. It was running hundreds of billions of dollars through a regular checking account at J.P. Morgan, and the bank is looking at this activity in and out of the account, and there are no signs of any security trading going on, and the funds are being transferred from one customer to another in patterns that really didn't serve any legitimate purpose. Well, so what happened in that case? Well, we never got to the merits because the judge threw Irving Picard out on claims of on the basis of standing and imperi delicto. Mm-hmm. So we may never know in that case. It's on appeal to the Second Circuit. But in another case, huge jury verdict in the Scott Rothstein case, Coquina Investors against TD Bank. A jury, this matter got to the jury, and the jury rendered a $67 million verdict, finding some punitive damages as well. Now there, you don't have a judge deciding it. It actually got to a jury, and the allegations were that the investors had been meeting regularly with the bank vice president and that the bank officer had been confirming to them, oh, your money's safe, it's in a locked account, it's there for the sole and exclusive benefit of you, and you have $22 million in your account when, in fact, there's only $100 in the account. So they get to trial, they get in front of a jury, they put Spinoza, the bank officer, on the stand, and what does he do? It's time to preserve himself. He takes the fifth, refuses to answer any questions. That was enough for the jury in that case, apparently, to render a very large verdict. So there are a lot of efforts right now to find not only banks but auditors and law firms as well liable on aiding and abetting theories.
Great. And to the best of your knowledge, is this the first time this TD Bank decision, the first time that a jury verdict has found a financial institution or other third party liable for aiding and abetting a fraud?
Well, there has been a lot of play over the years and a lot of runs at banks on this, and there are cases that really go both ways. Now, most frequently these things get resolved at the pleading stage of the case. For example, the defendant is going to file a motion to dismiss the case on procedural grounds or other grounds that the allegations are insufficient. There is a lot of case law out there that says if the plaintiff alleges the claim properly, this is a valid theory, and if there were allegations of actual fraud, of actual knowledge, and of substantial assistance, that claim is going to survive almost all the time. If a claim survives a motion to dismiss, these things are settling because they want to avoid jury verdicts like we just saw against TD Bank. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly authority out there to lead to the liability. Most defendants are going to settle these before we get to that point.
Got it. So has there been any fallout from the TD Bank verdict?
There has, and it continues to go on, day after day, just very recently, a few days ago. One of the first things we saw, well, obviously TD Bank has appealed the decision to the 11th Circuit,
right.
But more interestingly, they very quickly settled some other claims, apparently seeing the writing on the wall. They settled with another group of investors for about $100,000. We also saw this affect some other financial institutions. Gibraltar Bank then also went quickly and settled some claims as well for about $10 million, perhaps worrying about their own liability. Interestingly, those were two of the principal banks that were sort of thrown under the bus in Rothstein's deposition that took place in his bankruptcy case, where he's saying, I have these bankers in my pocket, and I invested and became a shareholder because I knew specifically that the bank didn't investigate shareholders, and so the testimony wasn't looking good for them. So there was some settlements that came out of after this verdict. Another interesting result is in the same Ponzi case, Scott Rothstein, the same defendant, TD Bank, but a different plaintiff, sued the bank, making pretty much the same allegations that the bank had made these representations that their money was in locked accounts and that they had actual knowledge and substantially assisted. It was in front of a different court, a different district court, and in that case, a motion to dismiss was filed, and the judge granted the motion to dismiss. So you have same facts, same defendant, same Ponzi case, and in the exact opposite result. So that's kind of interesting. The plaintiff was granted leave to amend the complaint, so we'll see if they do a better job alleging, and it actually makes it through. But at the moment, TD Bank got off the hook in another case. And then just in the past few days, one other interesting twist to the story, the plaintiff who got the $67 million jury verdict has discovered a piece of paper in another case that they says is evidence that TD Bank and its lawyers, potentially, were working a fraud on the court and had doctored a document that had been produced as evidence in the jury trial. And the plaintiff has now filed a motion for sanctions against the bank and against the law firm. It was a due diligence form that the other one that was produced in another case had high risk all over it, and it had shown that the bank really may have had actual knowledge of money laundering activities, and they had conducted an extensive investigation of Rothstein, whereas the one that was produced in the jury trial did not seem to have all that language, and it seemed to be removed. So the plaintiff is now looking to sanction the bank in whatever manner the court deems appropriate, and they want to refer TD Bank to the U.S. Attorney's Office for investigation of obstruction of justice charges, and they also want to refer the lawyer to the Florida Bar for investigation to see whether or not they had any role in doctoring evidence. So it goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, ACFCS just did a recent story about that due diligence form. It's a pretty dramatic development in the case.
I have to question whether there are any damages here because they already got their jury verdict. Perhaps,
right.
Perhaps they would have hoped for greater punitive damages, had they seen this or seen evidence of this tampering of documents.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see where this goes.
Yeah. So given these recent developments and given the TD Bank verdict, do you have any tips for how financial institutions or other third parties could avoid this type of liability?
But, there are some really easy, free things that people can do that they seem not to, which is curious to me. But, one of the first things I would recommend doing is doing a Google search and seeing if there's anything out there, there's any bad news coverage. Or you can do a nationwide litigation search and see whether there's already any lawsuits, questioning the honesty of the people that are running the whole business. You can do background checks, criminal background checks on the people running the business. And then the auditors, it's so interesting to me that people really just sort of trust audited financial statements. They never pick up the phone to call the auditor to see whether the auditor, in fact, prepared those statements or do a search on the auditor to see whether, in fact, it's an independent organization that has conducted the audit. We saw in another Ponzi case a few years ago in Bayou Group, had anyone done just a Secretary of State search on the auditor, they would have pulled up immediately that the registered agent for that auditor was actually the principal of the company being audited. This audit company had been established for the sole purpose of creating fictitious financial statements.
Oh, wow.
So, and there's other, just to generally be aware of the promises being made, are they no risk, guaranteed, really high returns? Is there a bunch of secrecy and exclusivity surrounding it? Is it an affinity deal? How has it made its way to you? And then just generally speaking, read the fine print and see whether this is a business model that actually makes any sense.
Great.
So just, some common sense tips there.
Right. Perfect. To switch gears a little bit now, we'll jump back into the perennially fascinating Madoff case. What are some of the warning signs that people should have seen in the Bernard Madoff case?
Well, of course, there's the good old, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. If anyone was paying attention, and just a very few were, they would have seen that Madoff was miraculously outperforming the market substantially month after month after month. Harry Markopoulos, who was the whistleblower, went into the SEC a few times, was frustrated because he said, look, I'm looking at month to month for 87 months between 1993 and 2000 what Madoff is doing, and he's making money. He only lost money in three of those 87 months. Well, the S&P 500 had been down 28 of those same months. So how is this possible? How is it that no one else has duplicated this strategy? So if anyone were really paying attention, they would have said, that doesn't make any sense. And again, around Madoff, you had this whole secrecy, exclusivity, and you just have to, it has to get the hair on the back of your neck rising up when you're the last one who's allowed into the plan. The other thing about Bernie Madoff, which was curious to me, is how people tolerated receiving paper statements in the mail after the trades had taken place. I saw a quote that Bernie Madoff had said while he was in the midst of his enterprise that market timing and stock picks are both important for the strategy to work. Well, he had to have been laughing because his market timing was, let me time it until after the market has closed and let me pick the stocks that performed well that day. Let me then make up a statement and mail it out to people. So, if you're investing in some sophisticated plan, you should be expecting some real-time results and probably electronically in this day and age. So that should have raised some red flags. And then, of course, you have the auditor in his case, which was a, one- or two-man shop in a strip mall handling, hundreds of billions of dollars of audit
right.
information coming in and out. And that should have raised some questions as well.
Right. Given that the case is still going on, and there's been some recent interesting developments, how do you feel about the recent settlement of Picard versus Katz?
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about that case. This is the Mets owner where the Madoff trustee was suing them for $1 billion of money that they had received from the whole Madoff enterprise. And right out of the box, or pretty early on, the district court judge threw out most of the $1 billion in claims on
right.
a couple of different theories and whittled it down to about $383 million. And that first cut where the court found that a certain safe harbor was applicable here, the stockbroker defense, it's often called under the Bankruptcy Code, Section 546E, which is a section that's intended to protect payments where a trustee can't avoid settlement payments made by or to or for the benefit of a stockbroker in connection with a securities transaction or securities contract. And the court said, well, you know what, most of this $1 billion I'm going to characterize as those types of payments and the trustee can't avoid them. I would have liked to have seen that particular aspect of this decision up on appeal. In the same case in Madoff, the lower court, the bankruptcy court, reached the exact opposite result and said, you know, that safe harbor was intended to promote stability and instill investor confidence in the securities markets. And, you know, here we have a whole fraudulent enterprise, and to extend that safe harbor here is going to undermine and not promote investor confidence. So you've got different courts handling this issue in a Ponzi case very differently, and I would have liked to have seen it taken up and have a higher court look at it, but that didn't happen. And then on the remaining aspects of the $383 million, $83 million of that was pretty well going to be recoverable by the trustee, and the court had indicated that that was the case. And as the other $300 million, there was a question of the good faith of the Mets family who had received this money, and had they acted in a willfully blind manner.
Right.
Well, the trustee on the eve of trial, I mean, literally the news came out that morning that they were selecting the jury, settled the whole thing for $162 million. And again, I have a mixed reaction to that. You know, I would like to see the trustee recover more money for the defrauded investors, but he was feeling some risk there, and the judge had definitely been giving Irving Picard a kind of a hard time in that case, saying, look, I don't think you're going to be able to prove what you're trying to prove, but fine, I'll let you take a run at it. So, you know, a settlement is always a good thing, but a $162 million settlement on $1 billion of claims, you know, you have to process it. I mean, there were definitely some risks for Irving Picard, and, you know, at least they've, you know, stopped fighting, so I guess that's good.
Right. Great. Well, Kathy, thank you very much for speaking with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this once again. And again, please visit www.theponzibook.com for more details on Kathy's book. This is a fascinating and developing subject, the issue of third-party liability and Ponzi schemes, and I'm sure we'll hear more of it in the future. So again, Kathy, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.